love your work. On this show, we help you make it as a creative, find your unique voice, find the right mindset to succeed, and be the first to capitalize on new opportunities to make a living making your art. I am David Cadavy. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast app. And if you want the very best of Love Your Work and the gems I've discovered in my thousands of hours of research into history's greatest creators, all in a short weekly email, sign up for my Love Mondays newsletter. That is at cadavy.net/Mondays. Dr. Robert Lustig is Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics, Division of Endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco, UCSF, where he specializes in the field of neuroendocrinology, in other words, how the brain regulates hormonal activity in the body. His research and clinical practice has focused on childhood obesity and diabetes. And Dr. Lustig believes the food business has hacked our bodies and minds to pursue pleasure instead of happiness by pushing processed food loaded with sugar. And as you'll see, the way that sugar triggers our brain chemistry isn't a whole lot different from the way technology triggers our brain chemistry, which is very relevant to prior discussions I've had on the podcast about how technology shapes our behavior. Dr. Lustig points to this confusion between pleasure and happiness, blaming it for having fostered today's epidemics of addiction and depression. And getting your creative work out into the world, finding a way to love your work, both these things require that you have a healthy relationship with your mind. And to have a healthy relationship with your mind, you need to have a healthy relationship with your definition of happiness. And this is why I was extremely excited to come across Dr. Lustig's book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. The book really brought a scientific explanation to much of what I've been searching, grasping at, trying to explain here on Love Your Work over the past few years. So in this conversation, you're going to learn why are pleasure and happiness neurologically different phenomenon? How do we confuse them for one another? How does the pursuit of pleasure reduce your ability to experience pleasure? The more pleasure you pursue, the harder it becomes to actually be happy. And you have heard that Coca-Cola used to have one addictive substance in it, cocaine. Hear the story that Coke doesn't want you to know about why the original formula had four different addictive substances. Thank you to our newest Patreon supporter, Mark Wiseman. Patreon supporters such as Mark keep the show going, which I speak from experience with the podcast that I support on Patreon. It feels really good every time you listen to a show that you are supporting on Patreon. Patreon supporters also get access to all sorts of perks, such as early access to ad-free interviews, discounts on Love Your Work merch, live office hours directly with me, and much more. For details, go to patreon.com/Cadavy. That is patreon.com/Cadavy. Here is Robert Lustig. I'm very excited to be talking to Dr. Robert Lustig today. Dr. Lustig is the author of The Hacking of the American Mind. And in the book, it says, marketing, media, and technology have capitalized on subverting our brain physiology to their advantage in order to veer us away from the pursuit of happiness to the pursuit of pleasure, which for them, of course, equals the pursuit of profit. So I think that the crux of this is this confusion between happiness and pleasure. So can you expand upon this distinction, Dr. Lustig?
Certainly. Thank you, David. In 10 words or less, I think that the entire United States population, and really, to be honest with you, the entire developed world has lost sight of these two completely separate yet overlapping positive emotions to the point where people don't actually understand the difference. So let me make clear what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about two separate but very specific positive emotions, both mediated by an area of the brain called the limbic system, which is basically your lizard brain, if you will. They're called pleasure and happiness, or reward and contentment. And people seem to think that they mean the same thing. They're not. So I distinguish seven differences between these two. I'll give you two in order. Number one, pleasure is short-lived, happiness is long-lived. So pleasure is like a good meal, happiness is like a good life. Pleasure is visceral, happiness is ethereal. Pleasure you feel in your body, happiness you feel above the neck. Number three, pleasure is taking, like from a casino. Happiness is giving, like Habitat for Humanity. Number four, pleasure is experienced alone. Happiness is usually experienced in social groups. Number five, pleasure can be achieved with substances like cocaine, heroin, nicotine, alcohol, sugar. Happiness cannot be achieved with substances. Number six, the extremes of pleasure, whether it be substances or behaviors. So the substances I just mentioned, or behaviors like shopping, gambling, internet gaming, social media, pornography. In the extreme, every single one of those leads to addiction. There's an aholic after every one of those. Shopaholic, sexaholic, chocoholic, alcoholic, et cetera. Whereas there's no such thing as being addicted to too much happiness. And number seven, and the reason for the book, pleasure is dopamine and happiness is serotonin. Now, two different neurotransmitters, two different areas of the brain, two different sets of receptors, two different mechanisms of action. You know, like, why do we care? Like, so what? They both feel good. They're both positive emotions. People strive for both of them. Well, the book argues that it matters a lot, that these are not the same. And there's a reason why. There's both an aesthetic reason and there's a scientific reason why it matters. So let me start with the scientific reason, because that will actually get us to the aesthetic reason. So dopamine, pleasure. So there is an area of your brain called the reward center. In Latin, it's called the nucleus accumbens. It is the reward center for all the rewards, bar none. Every single thing that triggers reward in your brain at any level goes through the nucleus accumbens. And basically, it is the transmission of dopamine from one neuron to the next neuron.
So if I'm eating ice cream, I'm stimulating the nucleus accumbens.
That's right. Every single one. You can pick your pleasure. That you get the choice of. But basically, how that pleasure gets transduced in your brain, you don't get to pick because they're all the same. Mm-hmm. So they all are transported through the same pathway. Dopamine binding to the dopamine D2 receptor in the nucleus accumbens. And when that dopamine binds to that receptor, you then get the feeling, you transduce the feeling of pleasure. Now, that's good, and we like it, and we seek it out.
It's important for motivation, right? So
it's motivation and reward. So it changes your behavior because you start seeking it out. Now, here's the problem. When dopamine binds to that receptor, the next neuron fires. Now, neurons like to be stimulated. They like to fire. That's why they have receptors in the first place. But neurons like to be tickled, not bludgeoned. Chronic overstimulation of any neuron anywhere in the brain will lead to neuronal cell death. Neurons are fragile things. And if you fry them, they don't come back. And chronic overstimulation leads to neuronal cell death. And we know this because as a pediatrician for 40 years, you know, I took care of a lot of kids in the neurointensive care unit who came in status epilepticus, you know, nonstop seizures. And we had to put these kids into pentobarbital coma to stop their brain from working, to stop their seizures so that we could actually preserve their neurons so they wouldn't end up vegetables.
So if I'm eating ice cream nonstop, I'm bludgeoning my dopamine receptors to the point that they just don't even work anymore.
Well, so what happens is, you know, those neurons, you know, they don't want to die. They have, you know, reasons to survive. So they have a plan B. They have a self-defense mechanism. What they do is they downregulate the number of dopamine receptors. So the there are fewer dopamine receptors on any neuron, which means that there's less chance that a circulating dopamine molecule that's floating around inside the synapse will even find a receptor to bind to.
So you need more and more of the stimulus at that point.
To get less and less.
To get the same effect. It's like the whole habituation of, you know, if you're drinking a lot of alcohol or you're doing a lot of a certain drug, you need more and more to get the same effect. And that's kind of what...
That's called tolerance.
Yeah, tolerance. Okay.
That's the phenomenon of tolerance. So dopamine induces tolerance. More and more to get less and less. So what does this mean in human terms? You get a hit, you get a rush, receptors go down. Next time you need a bigger hit to get the same rush, receptors go down. And then you need a bigger hit and a bigger hit and a bigger hit, bigger hit, until finally you need a huge hit to get nothing. So that's called tolerance. And then when the neurons actually do start to die, that's called addiction. And when those neurons start to die, they ain't coming back.
So what's the relationship between the neurons dying and addiction there? I'm trying to understand how that mechanism works.
So when the neurons start to die, now you have dopamine deficiency. And so now you will do anything to try to up your dopamine. And now you have gone from liking something through wanting something, and now you need something.
And so you're going for the stimulus over and over again, but it's not working because you don't have the receptors to
pretty much
to achieve the effect. And perhaps is there a neuroplasticity element to it where you're carving that pathway now, and now that's where most of the electrical activity in your brain is going to go?
Well, not exactly, but the bottom line is you're not able to transduce that signal pretty much anymore.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, the depths of addiction, and it's why it's so difficult to lift people out of addiction. So bottom line, you know, everything that drives dopamine, everything that drives pleasure in the extreme will lead to addiction. Now, that's not good. Serotonin, on the other hand, the happiness neurotransmitter, the contentment neurotransmitter, turns out it's not excitatory, it's inhibitory. It inhibits the next neuron from firing. Now, if you're inhibiting a neuron, any chance you're going to kill it?
Guess no.
So do you need to downregulate the receptors?
No.
I guess not. So there's no such thing as overdosing on too much happiness.
Yeah.
But it turns out that everything that makes your dopamine go up makes your serotonin go down.
Huh. Well, you know, this is something I've been thinking about a lot since I read your book. And something popped in my brain earlier when I was thinking about writing. You're a writer and you've done a lot of things that are very difficult to do, you know, becoming a medical doctor, for example. And I was thinking about how I get pleasure out of writing.
Okay.
That's the word that I used. And I said, wait, what would Dr. Lustig think of that?
Yeah, I don't think you get pleasure out of it. Yeah, I think you probably get happiness out of writing.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you, I subscribe to the Lillian Hellman School of Writing. I hate writing. I love having written.
Yes, we all do. Yes. Well, but I think that you're right. Like, I'm using the word pleasure, but like when I'm putting that word in my mind, I'm thinking more of a serotonin contentment feeling, actually. Maybe it's just that I have redesigned my life and my way of looking at my values such to the extent that now I use the word pleasure for contentment.
Well, so you have basically done exactly what everyone else has done, which is confused and conflated these two completely separate phenomena. And to be honest with you, that's exactly what American industry wants you to do, because they want you to believe that you can buy happiness.
Yeah.
Okay. Because if you can buy happiness, you'll plunk down your, you know, hard-earned money to purchase whatever it is they're selling. The problem is, the more you purchase, the less good you feel.
Well, I think fortunately for me, I think I've conflated in the other direction, where maybe what you're talking about is people who seek what is pleasure neurochemically, but to them that's happiness. And so I think to me, what's happened is that what is neurochemically contentment, I'm now calling pleasure. But talk about this this other side.
Well, if that were true, that wouldn't be so terrible. Then it would just be a semantic issue.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, because people say you can buy happiness, what ends up happening is you end up spending more and more to get less and less, and it ends up leading you into addiction. The reason, or not the reason, but the first glimmer of how this worked for me, actually, I talk about in the epilogue of the book, which was actually the reason, the impetus for writing it. I was giving a psychiatry grand rounds at an American medical school, oh, now 5 years ago. And the head of the outpatient recovery program was giving me a tour of the facilities. And she herself was a recovering heroin addict. And you know, she'd gotten herself all cleaned up and was doing quite well. And so, you know, I'm passing the time with her. She's showing me around. And I said to her, what does getting clean mean to you? And she said something that was very jarring that I sort of never really got over. And here's what she said. This is a direct quote. She said, "When I was shooting up, I was happy. What my new life has given me is pleasure."
Okay.
And I didn't say anything.
Oh, okay. So that's the way that she's conflated it. Okay.
Right. And I didn't say anything. I was just thinking, looking at her like, "Lady, you know, what you talking about?"
And, you know, she's just like me calling contentment pleasure, but she's also calling pleasure happiness.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I think that's why she was an addict. You know, or another one. So that just stayed with me. And when I got home, I asked some psychiatry friends of mine, "You ever hear of that before?" "Oh, yeah, I hear that all the time." And then I was on the phone with my sister-in-law, and she used to work for Pillsbury, which became General Mills. And so she stopped working for them in Minneapolis. But she still stayed friends with several of the other employees in the help center, you know, where they call, you know, you'd call in when you're popping fresh dough, had icicles in it and stuff like that. And they would have a gourmet club, every couple of months or so. And she had just had one, and one of her friends in the gourmet club who had had bariatric surgery said to her, "You know, you're always so nice and slim. How do you do that?" And my sister-in-law said, "Well, I don't eat when I'm hungry." And the lady said, "Hungry? Who's hungry? Eating's for happiness."
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm a pediatrician. I take care of obese kids for a living. I mean, I'd heard that before too. And it was just so clear that, you know, these people had basically gotten it wrong. So the question is, how come they got it wrong? And that's when I started doing some, you know, digging and some looking at the dark underbelly of American culture and came to the realization that this was very specific. This wasn't by accident that we don't know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually it's not a conspiracy, because a conspiracy would require collusion. You've heard that term before, between industry actors, you know, to create, you know, across the board malfeasance. And that's not what it is. What it is it's a plot, because each industry concern has figured this out for themselves. Okay. And they're all in competition with each other for market share, but they basically all adopt whoever's leading the pack is doing in an attempt to try to usurp market share.
Well, everything that you've described about the difference between serotonin and dopamine and the way that our brains respond to it point to me that the dopamine response, the pleasure response, just makes a better business. You get repeat customers. They always want more, you know, and if you're selling contentment, people get it and now they don't want more. So you're going
on to be honest with you. You can't sell contentment.
Oh.
Because all the things that increase contentment don't cost any money.
Hmm.
And that's the whole tail end of the book. That's the entire last section of the book, is what does lead to contentment. Turns out they're all things that are absolutely clinically evidence-based, guaranteed to work or your money back, except none of them cost anything, so no refunds. Mm-hmm. And they're all things your mother told you and you forgot. And there, I call them in the book the four C's, because they all start with C. And they're all behaviors that generate serotonin. The first one is connect. And that does not mean Facebook. In fact, it very specifically does not mean Facebook. It means face-to-face, eye-to-eye, person-to-person connection in the same room, talking at the same, to each other at the same time. And the question is, why does that work? Why does it have to be face-to-face? And why does that kind of connection, that kind of communication, that kind of conversation, why does that work? And the answer is because you have a set of neurons in the back of your head, in your occipital lobe. You can record from them. They're different. They're called mirror neurons, M-I-R-R-O-R. And what they're doing is they're reading the facial expressions of the person that you are talking to in real time. And what those neurons are doing is they're transducing those facial expressions that the neurons are reading into electrical impulses of their own, which then are transduced by your limbic system into happiness or contentment. And we have a name for this process. It's called empathy. So when you are reading other people's facial expressions, you are empathic. When you are not.
So instead of chat, get on FaceTime.
Well, FaceTime is better, but it's still not the same as being in the room.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of other things that you're picking up. There's a lot of other body English and other things that help, you know, shall we say, refine the empathy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is very specific and it is absolutely essential that it, you know, really take place in person. Mm-hmm. Not over a digital network, not over a keyboard, but in real time. And I can actually kind of like prove to you what the difference between pleasure and happiness is in terms of this phenomenon. It's called religion. Now, turns out there are 4,200 religions on the planet. So you could say, well, none of them work. That's why there are 4,200 of them. Mm-hmm. Or all of them work. Depends. You can go either way. There's one thing that all religions share in common. One thing. What is it?
That they all get together.
Correct. A meeting place. Mm. And that meeting place is very specific. And it is the thing that you derive peace of mind and also, you know, the establishment of interhuman connection through that process of the meeting place. Now, once the pastor or the imam or the rabbi or whoever starts opening their mouth, that's the dopamine.
Mm-hmm. So what's a non-religious person to do?
Oh, there's still plenty of places to have communication. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, your sewing group, you know, your quilting. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a whole bunch of different ways to have interpersonal connection that have nothing to do with religion.
Oh, okay. The religion isn't a requirement.
Just an example.
Yeah.
All right. But that's why religion works when it works.
Right.
It's also why it doesn't when it doesn't.
Why it doesn't when it doesn't?
Because you're not communicating. Because you are not empathizing. Because if you were empathizing, you wouldn't be pulling out AR-15s and mowing people down.
Mm-hmm. So when religion becomes in-group, out-group, and becomes...
Absolutely. Yeah. Then it's hate, which is dopamine.
Gotcha.
The insula drives dopamine. That area of the brain, which is disgust and hate, drives dopamine.
Hate is dopamine-driven.
Well, it can be.
Can be.
So number two is contribute. And that does not mean to your IRA or your 403B. That means outside of yourself to make the world a better place, contributing in the form of effort, in the form of philanthropy, in the form of volunteerism, contributing to something larger than yourself that also helps you maintain relation to in terms of identity to others. So basically understanding where you are in the grand scheme. Rick Warren wrote his book, The Purpose-Driven Life. You know, basically, it's all about contribution and not in a monetary fashion. In fact, lottery winners are about the least happy people on the planet when you actually look at the data. The big question everybody always asks me is, can you get your contribution through work? And the answer is yes, you can, if two provisos are met. Number one, if you can see how your work helps others. And number two, if your boss can see it too. If so, then you can derive your happiness via contribution through work. That's how I do it for the most part.
You're valued, you're appreciated.
Yep.
You're talking about purpose. So meaning would be, right.
Right. That's all serotonin.
Overlapping concept.
All serotonin. That's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Charity. These are all ways of improving contentment.
So maybe that's part of what, I guess when I think about writing or the fact that writing is kind of an uncomfortable process, mm-hmm. but when somebody reads it and tells me that it helped them in some way, mm-hmm. maybe that's part of what makes it something that contributes to my feeling of contentment.
Maybe. Could be.
Okay. Maybe that's under your next C. Maybe that's the cope.
Yes. So number three, cope. And cope means something very specific. It's three things: sleep, mindfulness, and exercise. So let's start with sleep. So it turns out sleep's super important. And if you're not sleeping, you are dopamining, but you are not serotonining. And sleep deprivation is an enormous problem in American society. 35% of adults get less than 7 hours of sleep per day, and 23% are clinical insomniacs. Hmm. And if you don't get enough sleep, that means you're jacking up cortisol, which is upping dopamine and actually downing dopamine receptors. So basically, you're really driving that pathway in a very, very bad negative way. In addition, cortisol reduces the serotonin receptor. So it's less likely you will get contentment also. So, dealing with sleep is a major issue. And of course, everything we do today deprives us of sleep, like, for instance, our screens.
So the less sleep you have, the more you're seeking that pleasure or seeking the dopamine. And at the same time, you're also not able to experience the contentment as well.
That's right. Okay. It's called Las Vegas. Okay. Then mindfulness. So the most dangerous word in the English language is multitasking. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because nowadays you have to be able to multitask to get a job. Problem is only 2.5% of the population can actually multitask. The other 97.5%, they're serially unitasking. They're making it look like multitasking, but they're actually not multitasking. They are serially unitasking, switching from one task to another. And every time you switch from one task to the other, you get a cortisol bump, which fries neurons, generates mm-hmm. stress. And you also lose 23 minutes of attention while you're refocusing on the next task. So you're basically making yourself a less effective task performer. You end up being less productive in all of your endeavors, which, is shown, very clearly through performance tasks. It's ultimately not good for you. And the thing is that you can take anyone who is even remotely a multitasker and you can make them miserable by giving them enough tasks to do. So the ultimate is what profession are like the ultimate multitaskers? Pilots. Okay. Pilots are like the supreme multitaskers. So they stuck pilots in an fMRI machine. And what they do is they add one task on top of another, like every 5 minutes. And every pilot ultimately broke. The question is at what level? usually it was a couple of tasks, you know, I mean, you know, more than the, you know, us mere mortals, but ultimately you could make any of them break. And what showed that they broke was their cortisol rise. So pilots usually are cool as a cucumber, but even, you know, if you add enough tasks, you can get them to break too.
Do they tend to be this 2.5% of the population? Yeah. I think it was that you said that were multitaskers, they can actually do multiple complex tasks at once.
That's right. So, you know, I mean, that's good. On the other hand, you know, even they can be overwhelmed. So imagine what that means for the rest of us, you know, the mere mortals in the world like me. So, you know, this whole concept of multitasking really has to be rethought. And right now, you know, that's sort of the watchword of, you know, the new economy. And if you can't multitask, you're screwed. But in fact, you know, you kind of shouldn't be multitasking. And then finally, number three of this group is exercise. So it turns out exercise has its own beneficial effects, not just on physical health, but on mental health. And it's actually been shown that exercise can be as effective as SSRIs at alleviating depression. And if you team unitasking plus exercise together, you can actually get off antidepressants entirely. So cope is like a huge thing. Get the cortisol down. And then the last one, number four of the four C's, cook. So it turns out there are three items in food that affect this dopamine serotonin balance. So number first one is tryptophan. Tryptophan is an amino acid. It's the rarest amino acid. It is the precursor of serotonin. You have to consume it, and it's relatively hard to come by. Items that have lots of tryptophan in it are eggs, poultry, fish.
So if you're a vegan, so to speak, if you're a vegan, it's
on the low side. You know, not, that's exactly right. It's really, you know, very, very rare in a vegan diet. So you need a fair amount of food in order to get enough serotonin, you know, from tryptophan. So that's number one. Number two thing is omega-3 fatty acids. So omega-3, where do you get that? Well, you get it from salmon, also marine life, you know, also not vegan, and flax. So you can get omega-3s from certain vegetarian sources. The reason why omega-3s are important is because they are anti-inflammatory. If you look at omega-3 deficient animals, there's an inflammatory haze around the synaptic boutons of the serotonin neurons in the contentment area of the brain. So if you're having trouble with that neurotransmission, you're going to be depressed. So omega-3 supplementation has been shown to actually improve depression. And then finally, the third one, and it goes in the opposite way, sugar. Too much leads to too little serotonin. Lots of dopamine, way less serotonin.
Right. Well, and I remember reading that for the tryptophan to get into the brain to be converted into serotonin, it has to kind of take a ride on something that the precursors of dopamine need to take a ride on.
That's right. So there is an amino acid transporter in the brain that transports the precursors for dopamine, that is phenylalanine and tyrosine, and also the precursor to serotonin, which is tryptophan. They share this amino acid transporter. And because tryptophan is so rare, it's much more likely that that transporter is going to be transporting tyrosine and phenylalanine. And so the more tyrosine and phenylalanine, it's like taxi cabs on New Year's Eve. You know, try to find one, okay, that's unoccupied.
There's no Ubers for your tryptophan to to make it to the brain.
There's not. You got to get that cab. And, you know, if it's raining, you're really screwed.
Hey, what's the rain? What's the rain?
The rain is the dopamine surge, if you will.
The 7X, you know, the, surge candy, pricing on New Year's
candy, the alcohol, etc.
Yeah.
So, you know, getting tryptophan to where it belongs and, you know, and getting it converted to serotonin so you can actually get some happiness is a, it's an active process. Hmm. You know, it doesn't just happen. So, you know, happiness tends to be hard to achieve. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why people have opted for pleasure. It's a whole lot easier to achieve. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's way less satisfying and it causes addiction and ultimately leads to depression as well.
I think we teased the listeners a little bit with this, not conspiracy, but I guess the way that everything around us in our world seems to be nudging us towards the dopamine.
Indeed. And it's not by accident because, hey, dopamine sells.
Yeah.
So I'll give you a couple of examples of how industry has sort of, you know, co-opted this whole pathway, you know, for its own purposes. Ever heard of the tag phrase, open happiness?
Is that an ad campaign?
For?
What was that?
Who was it for? Ad campaign for who?
I don't even know. I see very few ads. Okay.
It's Coca-Cola.
I live under a rock. So
I guess you do because it was their ad campaign. It was their tagline for their ad campaign for 10 years. the longest campaign in the history of the company.
Oh, wow.
So let's talk about Coca-Cola for a minute. All right.
Yes.
Okay. We're going to go back to 1886. Okay. Guy named John Pemberton. So it turns out John Pemberton was an Atlanta pharmacist who developed the formula that ultimately became Coca-Cola. Now, why did he come up with this formula? Turns out John, and this is, by the way, this is the part of the Coca-Cola story they don't want you to know. So if you go to the Coca-Cola Museum in Atlanta, nothing about this. Hmm. Turns out John Pemberton was a morphine addict. He was an Atlanta pharmacist who was a morphine addict. And the reason was because in the Civil War, in 1865, he was wounded. And he got his first dose of morphine and then his second dose. And he became a morphine addict, which is why he became a pharmacist. So he had ready access to morphine. Hmm. Problem is, if you're a pharmacist and you have ready access to morphine, you are not going to be very successful because you're going to shoot up the profits. Mm-hmm. And so this guy had ruined his health, his economy, his livelihood, his family. And he knew that he had to get off his morphine addiction. He knew that. So he experimented because he had access. And he came up with a concoction that had, count them, four separate hedonic substances, four separate addictive substances. It had cocaine. It had alcohol, it had caffeine, and it had sugar. Hmm. And it also had carbonated water, which you could only find in pharmacies back then because only pharmacies had the equipment to be able to pressurize the carbon dioxide to, you know, create the carbonation, which of course we called the soda fountain.
So that's why soda fountains are always in the old pharmacy. Yeah.
That's why. Okay. Because they were thought to have their own health-promoting properties, carbonated water. Hmm. So he put all those things together and created this thing called Coca-Cola. Now, as it turns out, it didn't work. Pemberton never beat his addiction. Hmm. Okay? Four separate addictive substances, but there wasn't enough for addiction transfer off his morphine addiction. And in 1888, Pemberton was penniless, and the only thing he owned was the patent to this concoction, and he sold it to a businessman in Atlanta by the name of Asa Candler for $2,500. Hmm. And Asa then knew what to do with it, and he ended up creating Coca-Cola, and then, you know, in 1911, Robert Woodruff took over, and it became the world's greatest brand. Hmm. Pemberton died 6 weeks after selling that to Asa Candler from, guess what? A morphine overdose.
Wow.
That is the story Coca-Cola does not want you to know.
Wow.
All right. So here's what I say. You got cocaine, you got alcohol, you got caffeine, you got sugar. Still wasn't enough. You know, so
well, now sugar is everywhere.
Well, they found out that caffeine and sugar was enough to keep you addicted.
Yeah.
And that's why it's in everything.
But yeah, sugar's everywhere. I mean, is it alarmist to compare sugar to cocaine?
No, not really. Let's put it this way. Cocaine is more addictive gram for gram, but sugar is more ubiquitous.
Right.
Gram for gram. And you can't get off it because it's in everything. It's in all of the processed food. And that's why it's in the processed food, because they know when they add it, you buy more. And now we have the data to show that a very specific metabolite of the fructose molecule, the sweet molecule in sugar, actually causes the damage to the liver, the de novo lipogenesis and the insulin resistance, and is driving type 2 diabetes, fatty liver disease, and virtually all the other chronic metabolic diseases we know about, including cancer and dementia.
Hmm. So I don't know if they still do this, but when there was the Komen for the Cure Yoplait yogurt tops that you were supposed to send in to help cure breast cancer.
Yep. Not so good.
Because it was sugary yogurt.
So there are two kinds of yogurt. There's yogurt and then there's Yoplait, or, you know, not just Yoplait, but I mean Danone or, you know, virtually any other. Okay. There's plain yogurt. Now, if you look at a container of plain yogurt, 6 ounce container of plain yogurt, how many grams of sugar? 7. All lactose, milk sugar, which does not have this effect, which is fine.
And because, you know, it's not fructose.
It's not fructose, right. It's lactose. And what happened? I mean, yogurt is, what is it? It's sour milk. You know, the difference between the milk that sours in your refrigerator and yogurt is that for yogurt, you choose the bacteria that does the souring. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you choose one.
Lactobacillus or...
Yeah, well, different ones, you know, different species, different strains. But ultimately, it's, you know, you choose the bacteria. All right, that's the big difference. Now, that's 7 grams because it was milk sugar. But now let's look at a strawberry yogurt from the same company. How many grams of that?
Mm-hmm.
23 grams.
Yes, a lot.
So that's 16 grams of added sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that are not lactose. And that's on purpose. And only in America is yogurt dessert. Only go from being sour milk to being dessert.
I'm somebody who really avoids a lot of sugar, but I also hear people say, oh, well, have some orange juice. It's natural sugar.
Yeah, no.
And I'm still no.
Nope. And the reason, so fruit is good. Okay, nothing wrong with fruit. Fruit juice is bad. So what's the difference between fruit and fruit juice?
Yes, what's the difference?
The fiber. So it turns out the fiber limits the absorption of sugar from the gut into the bloodstream, so it never gets to the liver.
Gotcha.
Thereby keeping your liver healthy, so you don't end up with this de novo lipogenesis, fat making, or insulin resistance. And if you're not absorbing it early on in the intestine, that means it goes further down the intestine, and that means that the microbiome, the bacteria, in the intestine will chew it up for them to stay alive. So even though you consumed it, you didn't get it. Your bacteria did.
Mm-hmm.
And so you feed your bacteria, but you protect your liver. So fruit works, but fruit juice, the fiber has been removed. Fruit juice does not.
So out of the great American breakfast, we're worried about the cholesterol in the eggs and we're worried about the saturated fat in the bacon, but really it's the orange juice that we should be worried about.
It's the added sugar in the breakfast cereal and in the orange juice that's the real problem.
Not even added sugar in the orange juice, right? Even if it's not added.
Right. Well, once you've taken the fiber away, it might as well be added.
Mm-hmm. It's added to a glass.
Right. So cook, because when you cook food, then you know what's in it.
Yeah.
You buy it processed. You also know what's in it. Lots of extra sugar.
Well, we could go on and on. I know that we're out of time now. I enjoyed the book so much. There was so much more that I wanted to dig into, and maybe we can come back again some other time. But I really highly recommend this book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. And we didn't get into the corporate takeover too much. But do you have a final message for our listeners and a place where you'd like for them to get more of you, Dr. Lustig?
Yeah, sure. I have one question to ask the audience for you to, it's your homework assignment.
Great. Yes.
So I'm going to solve it for you. The question is, what's the difference between marketing and propaganda? Marketing is using information to espouse your point of view. Propaganda is using disinformation to espouse your point of view. Mm-hmm. The difference is the truth. When a company tells the truth about their product, or about anything for that matter, they're marketing. And you're allowed to market. I'm not against marketing per se. But propaganda is another story. Using disinformation, when a company lies about their product, or about anything for that matter, that's propaganda. The difference is the truth. And what companies have done, and what our current administration has done, is it has sold us a bill of goods under a false premise. And propaganda is a problem. And that is what has happened to our entire society. We have been propagandized now to death. And you can't fix that problem unless you understand it.
Yeah, we don't even know what's real, right?
We don't know what's real or fake anymore.
It's like the Idiocracy scene.
That's right.
What's in Brando? It's got electrolytes. What's an electrolyte? It's what Brando has.
Right. There we are. Now you got it.
All right.
So we have a long way to go. We have a lot of work to do.
And where can they find more of you?
Well, there's a website, robertlustig.com. There is our nonprofit called Eat Real. REAL is an acronym. It stands for Responsible Epicurean and Agricultural Leadership. We praise the good. We are a trust mark that restaurants, cafeterias, medical centers, school districts can earn that if they procure, market, and sell real food. So from the bottom up, kind of like LEED certification for buildings or fair trade, people look for that trust mark because they know that if they see a green fork in the window of a restaurant, they know that if they eat there, it won't kill them, which is kind of valuable. I hope to have another book out on what's wrong with the healthcare system soon. And, we're plugging along. So, Fat Chance, The Hacking of the American Mind, the documentary Fed Up, Sugar Coated. There will be a documentary out next year on technology addiction, which I am part of. So I'm easy to find.
Great. Well, thank you so much for doing all this extremely meaningful work. I'm sure that it brings you a lot of contentment.
It's my purpose. It's my serotonin. And, I'm not giving it up.
All right. Dr. Lustig, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Is Love Your Work helping you find your unique creative voice? Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation you need to become the creator and human you want to be? If so, please be a part of making this a special and nourishing and thoughtful show. Support the show on Patreon. You'll be an even bigger part of this show than you already are. If you contribute just a coffee a month, you'll be helping support the hosting and production of Love Your Work. Everyone has some unique creative gift to offer the world. Together, we can give people the tools they need to bring that work into the world. The world will be better off for it. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/cadavy. This is a different kind of model for supporting the work that you love. The choice is yours. Vote with your dollars, put your money where your mind is, and keep Love Your Work going. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/cadavy. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at patreon.com/cadavy. That's patreon.com/KA, D as in David, A, V as in Victor, Y. And if you can't support the show financially, and you've listened to at least 3 episodes, can you do me a favor? Write a review on Apple Podcasts. You can consider it your donation to help support the show. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by our Patreon supporters, such as mini sponsor Paula Spriggs, and top supporters such as Jeffrey Mason and Vitas Pinkovicius. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Dorena, from the album About Everything and More, by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.